Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer Radio Show, brought to you by Tractor Supply, where we give away more chicken coops and chicken-related prizes than anyone else on the planet. We are often imitated, but never duplicated. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer, author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens, and national spokesperson for the USDA Biosecurity for Birds program. Today is Monday, April 15th, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Each week, we welcome experts in their field to share their knowledge about different topics, including backyard poultry, show poultry, heritage poultry, gardening, cooking, and, of course, living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Be sure to visit our website, chickenwhisperer.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Once again, I would like to thank all of you for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Tractor Supply.
Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, hens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com. Or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing.
And you can find all the great Ware products here.
Critter-Cages.com is your one-stop shop for all your critters' housing needs. They stock a wide selection of supplies and equipment for rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, mice, rats, ferrets, chinchillas, chickens, and other small critters. Their chicken selection includes chicken barns, chicken coops, and chicken yards from top manufacturers. Your critters will love their selection of quality products, and you'll love their low prices. Visit them online at critter-cages.com. That's critter-cages.com. When you need an incubator, think Brensey, the incubation specialist. Brensey has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Brensea.com. Brensea spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Brensea.com or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg handlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Brensea, technology you can trust.
Ideal Poultry has been a family-owned and operated business since 1937.
Their business is built on customer service and quality poultry, from rare white and brown egg layers to broilers, ducks, turkeys, and bantams. Ideal Poultry is the largest supplier of backyard poultry in the United States, shipping close to 5 million chicks annually. Visit them online at idealpoultry.com. That's idealpoultry.com.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
All righty. Thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. It's good to be back. We're back at the homestead. Hadn't been here for too many hours. We arrived and pulled up at the homestead at 3:35 a.m., and probably didn't get actually the shut-eye that we wanted to get until about 4:30 once getting all the kids situated. But we didn't unload too much out of the Chicken Whisperer Mobile last night. But we had an absolutely fabulous time at the Alabama Chicken and Egg Festival, let me tell you. We had fun last year, but this year I would say it was 10 times that amount of fun that we had up there in Moulton, Alabama. If you missed it, you missed an awesome, awesome weekend that you could have spent with your family and friends and made new friends as well. It was just fabulous. We had a great time. We actually headed out on Friday. We were hoping to leave Thursday and make a little two-day trip out of it, but we had some bad storms that came through. So we left Friday morning, which was fine. We just made the one long haul up there. And got up there Friday afternoon, got the camper situated next to the big Academy Sports tent that we had sponsored there for our presentations. And then Tractor Supply, of course, sponsored my trip up there. And it was absolutely awesome. They had the sound system set up, the bleachers set up, the big Academy Sports tent set up there for me. We pulled the RV right next door to that tent, and I got all situated. And then I didn't have anything scheduled Friday night, so we had some free family time. Let me tell you, we went over to the poultry show. There was the ABA sanctioned poultry show there. So we went over there and saw lots and lots of beautiful, beautiful birds. As always, met a lot of good people, went through the sales tent and saw what was available for sale over there. Saw a lot of chicken artwork, a lot of chicken vendors over in that area, which was absolutely a super time. Then, of course, we had to partake in some good family time. They had a nice train that Caleb loved to ride, so spent a little bit of the profits over there letting Caleb ride the kid train and the kid airplanes to go around and around and around. So he had probably a better time than any of us at the Alabama Chicken and Egg Festival. And then, of course, we got to see some good bands. Probably Friday night, the biggest name band, if you're into country music, was Shenandoah. And so it was good to hear some of their old, they had 13, I think, number one hits. And so it was good. I think they played all 13 of them, I believe they said, that night. So it was a good musical concert. And we did partake that night. Okay, Fitness Flock members, you're going to have to cut me some slack. We did enjoy one funnel cake, but we shared it between the three of us. Myself, Jen, and Kayla, but we had a great time. And then we got into some poultry education. On Saturday, I had four workshops, just 30 minutes each throughout the day. We talked about brooding and incubation and coops and predators and brooders and all kinds of great stuff. And again, we packed the house this year just like we did last year. It was standing room only there under the Academy tent for the Chicken Whisperer presentations. So we had a good time. In between there, again, we had some good family time where we could enjoy the Alabama Chicken and Egg Festival. So we really had a good time. It ended there around 5 yesterday, of course, Central Time. So it ended at 6 our time here at the homestead. And once we got the Chicken Whisperer Mobile, the RV all hooked up to the SUV, we headed out. And I went a different route home, which was fine. I 280 from Columbus up to Birmingham is nothing but hills, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. I said, enough of that. So we came back a different route, which was fine. It maybe was about an hour longer, but it was much easier on the vehicle and us and the ride and everything else. So it wasn't too bad. Well, like I said, we rolled back in about 3:35 a.m. And so not much sleep, but that's nonetheless, that goes for the territory when you're spending a lot of time on the road. Speaking of on the road, we've got 3 days to turn the camper over and get everything prepared for our next event next weekend. We're going to be leaving Thursday, and we're heading down to another part of Alabama. We're heading down to Mobile, Alabama. The Mobile Master Gardeners and Book Club have invited me down there for a presentation on Saturday, next Saturday, April 20th. There's probably still a few seats left. I think their charge, it's $28 a person, I believe, what they're charging, and it does include a box lunch on Saturday. And there'll be two guest speakers there in two rooms. So in the morning time, I'll have a chance to teach a lot of people about backyard poultry and spread the chicken love. And then that afternoon, they switch. The people who are in the other class with another author, they'll come over to my class that afternoon and learn about backyard poultry. And I'll get another chance to spread the poultry love to a lot of people and educate them on all the great benefits of keeping backyard poultry. So that's going to be next weekend. It's going to be a packed weekend, though. It's going to be fun. We're going to meet a lot of people. Apparently, we're being taken out to eat to some good Gulf seafood there in Mobile on Friday night. And then Saturday night, there's a big poultry club there in Mobile, the Mobile area, or Mobile Bay Poultry Fanciers or something. And they're going to be, I believe, taking me out to eat on Saturday night with the family. And then Sunday, the big poultry club has rented a pavilion at the state park, and we're all bringing, I guess, a cover dish to that. And so it's going to be really, really fun there on Sunday. And then from there, I think we are heading out for our official spring break with the family. Y'all know that I normally take just 4 weeks off from broadcasting a year officially. I take the week of Thanksgiving off. I think it's important for family and for you to and spend time with your family and not have to listen every day at noon. I take the week between Christmas and New Year's off. I take a week at spring break off with the family, and then I take a week in late summer off before Jen has to head back to work as a school teacher. We always give her a week to recoup before she has to head back to school. So I believe that, and it's my birthday next Monday, the 22nd, will be my birthday. So I think we're going to take that week off, the week of the 22nd. No shows, no business, no nothing like that. And I'll still be posting on Facebook the secret passwords for the coop contest, okay? Yes, we're right smack dab in the middle. It is the 15th today of an awesome chicken coop contest. We give away more coops than anybody on the planet. And we've got another coop we're giving away from My Pet Chicken, mypetchicken.com, Derek and Tracy. We gave a chicken coop away last month and the month before, and I think the month before that, and we gave away two chicken coops in the month of October. So again, continuing to give away more coops to our awesome fans and listeners than anybody on the planet. But are you collecting the secret passwords? Every day for the month of April, there's 30 days in April, every day I'll be posting a secret password on my Facebook page, which will obviously be copied over to our Twitter page, and collect those secret passwords. You'll have a chance by collecting those secret passwords to win this awesome chicken coop contest. Also, a little bonus this time, embedded in the secret passwords is a secret code or a secret message. So you can start trying to find that secret message within the secret passwords that I post every day. And there may be a bonus prize if you can tell me what the secret message is that's been embedded into the secret passwords. So how cool is that? So every day, sometime on my Facebook page, I'll post a secret password, jot those down, write them down, and then on May 1st, we'll be having that contest. We'll be giving away that awesome chicken coop from mypetchicken.com. Okay. Also, in probably mid-June, I got to work on it a little bit today, we'll be doing the Power to the Poultry Tractor Supply Tour again for the second quarter, sometime around the first to probably mid-June, and I believe we're going to be hitting the Carolinas, North Carolina, South Carolina, maybe a little bit of South Virginia, maybe Eastern Tennessee. Looking forward to that. I don't have a route yet. That's what I got to work on. I'm going to work on my route, and then I'm going to hand that over, and the days, hand that over to Tractor Supply, and they're going to pick the best stores for the big Tractor Supply events that we do with them. So I'm looking forward to that week-long, maybe 10-day-long trip coming up in June as we hit the road again on the Power to the Poultry Tour with the Chicken Whisperer and Tractor Supply. We got a great show lined up for you today. As always, on Monday, we have Peter Brown, the chicken doctor, and he's been working very hard on a special show for you today, all about incubation. And when I talk about, you know, hey, you can talk hours and hours about incubation, and we try to squeeze the main things in when I'm on the road and talking and teaching about incubation, but Peter Brown,
He has a really neat concept for our show today. He's going to get into a lot of detail, a lot of technical detail, do a lot of troubleshooting, I believe. So I'm glad you're here. You do not want to miss the show. Go ahead, all our regular listeners, get out those Chicken Whisperer spiral notebooks. You got CW written on the front, and that you take all the notes on Monday through Friday when we have the expert guests come on and share their knowledge. And share their knowledge about keeping backyard poultry and all the topics that we cover here. So get those out. You're going to want to take a lot of notes today, a lot of expert advice, and a lot of technical advice, and just a great, great show today with Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, founder of FirstStateVetSupply.com. Visit them online, FirstStateVetSupply.com. I tell folks, if they don't have it, you probably don't need it. So let's go ahead and get started with our special guest segment, today. Today's special guest segment is brought to you by NatureWise Natural Poultry Feeds by Nutrina. NatureWise Natural Poultry Feeds by Nutrina are the natural choice for nutritionally balanced feed for your flock and contain only fresh, wholesome ingredients. Learn more at NutrinaNatureWise.com. That's NutrinaNatureWise.com. All righty, thank you for staying with us. Yeah, just real quick, you know, if you missed the Alabama Chicken and Egg Festival, it was the 9th annual. I know they got big plans for next year, being the 10th annual. It's in Moulton, Alabama. 20 bands, 3 different stages, all types of music, bluegrass, rock, southern rock, gospel, you name it. It's awesome. 20 bands, 3 stages, rides for the kids, tons of food vendors, contests. We saw a clucking contest. We saw egg-eating contest, chicken wing eating contest, egg toss contest for the kids and adults, but it was a hoot, and we had a really, really good time. Plus, they have an area called Down on the Farm where they have tons and tons of crafters that come in and sell their homemade items, plus educational folks that come in and teach you about, you know, again, ironworks, and they had somebody doing Down on the Farm with shearing the sheep, so it's educational as well, but what a load of fun. They had over 25,000 people attend this weekend. Yeah, 25,000. So you ought to make it a plan to go next year if you can. 10th annual Moulton, Alabama Chicken and Egg Festival. It was awesome. Alrighty, heading over to the phone lines now. We're going to bring on Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, founder of First State Vet Supply. Peter, welcome today. We're all excited and looking forward to the show today.
Hey, Andy, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. A little tired being rolling in at 3:30 a.m. from about a 7-8 hour drive, but nonetheless, we are here. It goes with the territory. You're familiar with that as you travel the country and hit those poultry shows with basically your traveling store.
And know so all about it.
You know all about it. Yep. So someone said earlier today, I kind of sound like an NPR. I sound like an NPR host. Because of my voice, it still hasn't regained. But anyway, so after talking for 2 days and teaching for 2 days and whatnot in the drive and what have you, so no, this is not NPR, folks. This is Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer today on Blog Talk Radio. But it is not NPR. But yeah, so thanks for joining us. We're looking forward to learning all about incubation today. I know you got a little twist with it, but and I'm sure, like I posted on Facebook, we're going to hear a lot of information today from you that we probably have never heard before. So we're ready to roll.
Yeah, you know, when I had sent you the email and whatever about, you know, what I wanted to talk about, it's kind of evolved from that. I responded to a couple of things on Facebook about chipped eggs, this, that, and the other thing, and disappointment in eggs that were shipped that didn't hatch or didn't hatch well or other things. And so I thought, in addition to the other things that I was going to talk about and will talk about, this will probably end up being a two-show deal simply because of the enormity of the information that we need to put forward. But all of that being said, you know, one of my comments on the Facebook thing was that, eggs weren't made to be shipped in the first place. That's not their design. That's not their nature. We are grateful and lucky that we are able to do so, and for the most part have pigs that are viable and hatch and do well. But the downside of it is that in many cases, you don't know where you're buying the eggs from. You buy them off of eBay or wherever the case may be, and there always seems to be some sort of tragedy associated with these things. And one of them, and this has got basically nothing to do with what I talk about and everything else, but having, you know, being in technically in the shipping business, like it or not, for many, many years, one of the things that came up was the boxes that, you know, so the post office destroyed your eggs because they didn't handle the box right. But and many times in the course of shipping, you know, these things do happen, some on purpose, maybe some purely by accident. But, you know, a lot of the pictures of the boxes and things that people put up, I commented on those boxes were never meant to have eggs put in them in the first place, certainly nothing fragile. And other boxes were boxes that were reused or repurposed. While that's fine and dandy on one hand, it's not acceptable on the other hand. Generally, when you take a box that's fairly large and you ship it with whatever the contents were in it, it has taken a beating from the time it left your hands to the time it got in the hands of the recipient. And in many cases, the box is all beat to heck, half crushed all around in different places. And so they're never meant to be reused, although, you know, people do that. I very rarely reuse a box here simply because of that. So I made the comment, and that a simple looking for a better box, you'd be better off to go to Uline if you're going to be shipping eggs, and to alleviate the controversy of this. And for a couple, $3 a piece, you can get a double-walled box that's going to withstand that beating that a box takes. And so I just wanted to throw that out there at the start, because this is part of the entire conversation here. It starts with the beating up of the eggs and all of that, and the handling and so on. And then I'm going to attempt here to discuss, you know, what a person may do who is shipping eggs to help get a better hatch. Because I don't think anybody out there, and maybe I'm naive about it or whatever, but I don't think anybody out there deliberately is trying to push eggs that are either unfertile or not fit. I think the biggest problem that I've ever seen over the years is those that don't know, that just assume that putting two birds together in a pen and the female lays the eggs and you ship them and everything's hunky-dory. While it works that way on the surface, it's much, much deeper than that, much deeper than that. And, you know, we've talked about this. You know, last year we went into incubation itself, actually the embryology part of it more so. We went into every little detail, every little cell and everything that comes up. I don't want to do that this time around. This time around I want to talk more about what happens when there is a failure within the breeder flock itself. And that failure can come in many different ways. But the yet unfinished book that I have, two of them, will not even go there. You know, the one of them that deals with the embryology part of it, but it also deals with, you know, how to correct a lot of these problems that people see in their birds. So I just want to start out by and this is part of the book. A lot of the stuff that we have we'll be putting out today and possibly next week as well is basically stuff that I have written and have as part of this book. So you're going to kind of get a preview to a degree. It has nothing to do with trying to sell the book. It's not even ready for publishing at all. But this is information that I've put together in an attempt to help alleviate some of these situations. If it helps somebody out there, that's fine. So all of this starts with the breeding flock. I don't care who it is. I don't care where it is. I'm not talking about anybody in particular. I'm not talking about any particular event. So I don't want people to say, well, it's not my birds. I don't care whose they are. I don't care who you are. This applies to everybody across the board that is rearing chickens for the purposes of reproduction, okay? And when you do these things, you want to make sure that before you even put your breeders together that these birds are healthy. And that doesn't mean going out there and looking at everybody they look good to you, so therefore you put the males and females together and you start collecting eggs and you start shipping eggs and everything else. Certainly that is done all the time, I'm sure. But it is my interpretation that by examining the breeding flock and getting all the abnormalities cleared up before you even begin to put them together alleviates many of the problems that you run into down the road. I've seen people, on various sites, many sites that I visit, I never comment. It's an interesting, unique thing that I've even commented on these things on this particular group on Facebook, but it's all been congenial, and I think that's the reason why I continue to do that with them. The eagerness to learn and ask a very poignant, very very pointed, very good questions just motivates me to do even more. So that's what it's all about. It's all about learning. It's not finger pointing. It's how can we get this whole thing straight? So if you're going to start with your breeder flock, you want to make sure that you take care of any problems, mites, lice, coccidiosis, any external parasites, certainly, and you want to take care of any internal parasites. You want to take care of any respiratory issues that may come up. And here's a tip that I've thrown out before, and maybe some new listeners that have come off that Facebook page or any place else where they've heard about what we're going to talk about today. Here's a little tip for everybody. If you take your birds one by one and you close their beak and you put your fingers over the nostrils, just hold it there for 20 seconds, 30 seconds, and they start bubbling from the corner of the eyes, okay, they have a respiratory issue going on. It's not showing itself. I can't tell you right now what it is. I can guess. That would be fairly accurate. But there is an issue going on there that needs to be mitigated before or taken care of before you put these birds together. And therein lies a lot of the problems that we see with birds that don't produce enough eggs, or the eggs may not be fertile because the male has got a problem with a respiratory issue and he's not willing to mate. There's all kinds of things that go on in this particular type of a situation. So you want to make sure that you have all your worming done. You want to make sure that you treat birds for coccidiosis. And if you're going to treat birds for coccidiosis, after you've put them together, you never want to use any of the sulfur drugs, because that can cause mottling of the egg yolk, and that can cause infertility or early embryo mortality and that kind of stuff. So the foundation of your whole project here is this breeding stock. It isn't necessarily the progeny to come from. That's the aftermath of good, solid management of this breeder flock. Okay, so it's no different than taking care of your car. If you never want to change the oil, I would suspect that at some point prematurely you're going to have a ring job, valve job, or engine job. Okay, so this is kind of like the same thing. If you don't take care of these guys now, you will have problems later. And I know there's going to be somebody out there that never does anything and everything is hunky-dory, and I'm glad for you. Okay, and I'm not talking about, like I said, anybody in particular or whatever. But this just came up as a real good, solid conversation off of this Facebook page, which was in line with something that I had already decided to do with you and I, Andy. We'd already talked
about. Sure, right.
So it just all fits. So I'm just putting more to it, trying to explain how you get these real good hatching eggs from these birds that are going to be much more viable, and it makes everybody happy. I mean, if I were shipping hatching eggs to somebody and they called me and say, hey, look, you did a great job of packing the eggs got here, I've got them incubated, I've candled them, they look good, and on hatch day they all hatch out and everything else, you call me back and say, hey, you know, look, I got 10 out of 12 or 11 out of 12, I don't know why either party wouldn't be just as tickled to death, and I don't know why that shouldn't be the goal, because it's not very hard to get there. And then it's so much harder to go somewhere and try to defend yourself, in an open forum type of situation. So the first thing you want to do is go through and do all these things. Get all the coccidiosis, the worms, the respiratory issues, certainly the mites, because mites will interfere with production because the birds are just too busy trying to get rid of the itching and the biting and all the other things, and it saps their energy, and they don't eat as much, and then you have further problems with embryo development and those kinds of things. So you have to take care of the breeder flock. I'm not going to go into the incubator itself like we did the last time. That's something that everybody should be doing, their incubator maintenance, taking care of it. If you've got an incubator that takes a wafer, for God's sake, spend the $7 and buy one once a year, even though the other one isn't any good, or keep a fresh one around in case the other one goes bad, because lo and behold, when you least expect it, when you have your most important hatch that you want, I don't know about anybody else, but that always happens to me when I want something to happen the way I want it to happen. If I don't do all my due diligence and keep everything on an even keel, it comes back to bite me as a general rule. So, you know, if you've got a extra snap switch, keep one around. They're not all that big a deal as far as money. If you never use it, it's the best money you ever spent. But if you don't have it and you need it, then it becomes a catastrophe. So those kinds of things, if you've got bigger incubators that have other types of heating systems, you want to make sure you check everything out and keep everything up in good shape. No different than your car, same thing. Good maintenance gives you good hatch. That's a general rule. And that kind of thing. So if you take care of the breeder flock, generally it'll take care of you in the ultimate end. One of the things that I'd like to point out here is that a lot of people forget about this. The title, or tentative title at least, of my book is The Pregnant Egg. And most people don't think of an egg along those lines. A mammal, let's take a human that is pregnant, we can adjust things that happen to the embryo as we go along. A woman, for the most part, will go to a doctor, and a doctor will say, well, here, take this multivitamin because you need to take a multivitamin. There are people both sides of the fence that believe it, don't believe it, whatever. What I'm just trying to do here is draw an analogy of this thing. Eggs are different. It's a embryo encased in a hard shell. And once that takes place, anything that's deficient, there's trouble. And therein lies the reasoning behind taking care of that breeding flock. Because as that egg is laid and that shell is put down, you now can't fix it. So whatever hatches out of that, whether it be deficient in vitamin A or vitamin D or any of the B vitamins, that embryo, that chick, when it hatches, will suffer the consequences of that. Okay, whether that's an open skull, whether that's a yolk that didn't get retained or dead in the shell from different things, or vitamin deficiencies causing shortened legs, clubbed down, all of these different things can be, for the most part, okay, mitigated. We talked about this last week. Actually, we had, 2 weeks, we talked about supplementation, and how all supplements are not necessarily created equal. Okay, just to give you, for instance, if you want to talk about nutrition deficiencies that are detrimental to hatching, most people will jump on vitamins right away. But most people don't know that a deficiency of magnesium in the bird, or manganese, okay, can cause late embryo mortality, 18 to 21 days, right in that time frame. So those dead in the shell could be, I'm not saying they are, could be from a lack of that trace mineral. And you generally are not going to find that trace mineral available in your run-of-the-mill vitamin pack. It's not going to be there, because most of your run-of-the-mill vitamin packs give you your water solubles, your fat solubles, and then they throw in a little bit of sodium and potassium, maybe a probiotic and everything else, which I'm not condemning it. It's all good. But at the end of the day, if any of those trace minerals end up being deficient, you start ending up having this embryo mortality. The other thing I want to say is that we're all taught incubation basically takes 21 days. Technically, it takes about 22 days, not quite, but somewhere in that range, because as soon as the egg is fertilized, that embryo development starts. And it can be as much as 23 hours before that egg is laid, and it's still at the internal temperature of the dam. So by the time that egg hits the ground, or a nest box, or wherever it's going to be laid, it's already incubated for 24 hours, or 23 hours, or 22 hours, just depending. So at that point, that egg is very fragile. So why would we not treat that egg the same as we might treat a cow that is with calf, or a pig that is going to have piglets, or a sheep that's going to have lambs? Why wouldn't we try to treat that the same? And that's what this is kind of all about, to make people aware of the fact that once it gets encased in that egg, even before so, once that ovum is ovulated, it's done. The connection to the dam is finished. Not so in the others. We can correct some things. We can go along and we can supplement, and we can try to get these situations straightened out so that they don't come about. Okay, but once it's done, it's done. So if the breeders aren't right, the embryos aren't going to be right. If the embryos aren't going to be right, then the chicks aren't going to be right. And we see it all the time. I answer questions all the time from people. People calling me, people emailing me. I got this kind of problem. I got that kind of problem. There seems to be a lot of prolapse going around now, okay? Some of it's in the bigger breeds, okay? We start looking at genetic problems. We start looking at birds that are improperly fed. We start looking at birds that have too much of a fat pad, too much fat, too big a body, too small a body for the size egg they're laying, frame-wise, okay? They weren't reared properly somewhere along the line. And it doesn't mean the person did a bad job. Again, it goes back to knowing and not knowing. And that's what this show is all about. We always try to tell people, as best we can, you know, what they should do to try to correct a problem. Does it always work 100% of the time? No, it doesn't. Nothing ever does. But certainly being armed with the proper information is much better than not knowing at all and just shooting in the dark or just putting the birds together and hoping it all comes out of the egg okay. And in many cases, it does. In many cases, it does. The quality of the feed that you feed makes a huge, huge difference. We've seen that. We've run the gamut of folks that fed scratch and we're expecting eggs, and the others that were feeding cracked corn and expecting eggs. Not going to happen, as a general rule. So all of the things, whatever you do to those breeders, will end up in those eggs. And whatever is or isn't done in that respect will end up in that chick that you're going to put on the ground. And therein lies, you know, a lot of the problems. If the nutrients that, so you can go back and you can look and you can say that, well, they have the yolk to rely on. Yes, they do. But if that yolk is not nutritionally correct, if there are things missing or deficient or not enough in that yolk that the embryo is going to take in through the umbilicus and use as its food for the next 72 hours, then abnormalities happen within that chick. We talked about that for the last 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That intersection, that three-way intersection I talked about, you know, and the one vitamin stuck in the middle and two or three other vitamins all around, and nobody can jump in the middle. They all need to jump in the middle, but one of them is deficient and won't allow it to make the jump, and that's basically it. So the same thing happens here with the embryo. So we see a lot of this stuff. I see a lot of people, posting different things. Some I comment on, some I don't. Some I get too long-winded, and I'm not the greatest typer in the world. So I did invite folks from that forum to come and listen, whether they could listen today, and to the point that it was archived as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some people said that, you know, they weren't able to listen at this hour of the day, and that's fine. That's why the show is there for them to listen to afterward. But one of the other things that is extremely important. So we've gone through and we've taken care of the breeding stock. We've decided we're going to supplement. We've made sure they don't have all these abnormalities and so on. So we've gone through, and now we're going to supplement that breeding flock. And I would do that for about 14 days prior to putting the birds together, okay? Once you've got all your any problems that you have mitigated or under control, and then I would do about 14 days of supplementation, and then I would put my breeding stock together. And then I would back that off to maybe two or three times a week just to keep it in there. Because, as we said on the show before many, many times, I'll say it again, the chicken laying an egg is a monumental undertaking. Mm-hmm. And it is huge. And understanding that it takes approximately 50% or so of the calcium in the bird's body on a daily basis to put down a shell is huge. And if you're not replacing this, you start to run into abnormalities. We start to run into the rubber eggs. There were some folks that were having problems with that. And somebody else jumped in, had a different opinion, and I just stayed out of it. But generally, it's very simple. It's a lack of an imbalance of the calcium phosphorus ratio and vitamin D3 as a general rule. And sometimes you can correct it by giving some oyster shell, but generally it's better to try to correct it by doing both. Give the oyster shell and some vitamin A, D, and E powder in a drinking water, and usually it'll correct itself very quickly as a general rule. And all that means is that there was that three-way intersection again. There wasn't enough of something to make the whole thing complete, so we put the rubber part of the thing on, and there was not enough calcium to put down the shell, so it didn't happen. And that can be genetic, too. That can be an abnormality where the bird just does not have, no matter what you feed it, no matter what you do, as soon as you take away something, it goes back to being deficient again. That supplementation that we were taking, talking about the last couple of weeks. So all of those things come into play as to how these things are going to turn out at the end of the day. The fragility of the egg, it really is fragile in most cases. It needs to be treated maybe with a little bit more respect. When you're going to ship them, put them in a good box. Put a lot of cushioning in. Leave 3-4 inches all the way around so that if the box does get dinged and banged a little bit, it's not banging on the eggs. It's going to be handled, and I don't know what people are thinking when they ship eggs in the first place. I don't think, the postman is not putting it in their car, driving it clear across America, and then dropping it off at the post office and doing likewise there. I ship a lot of stuff, and I'll tell you right now, I don't put a bottle of a gallon of Oxine in a 14-cube box because I want to. It's necessary if you want it to get to where it's going and not leaking all over the place. It's just the way it is. And that doesn't matter whether it goes post office, FedEx, UPS, doesn't matter. Moving so many packages every day, you can't get them all there unbroken. It just isn't going to happen. It's not feasible. So you need to take the utmost of care and understand that this egg has been growing for at least 24 hours. Now, with all of that being said, the care of the egg afterward, if you're shipping eggs to somebody, and doesn't matter who, where, what, and why, okay, I'm going to assume, and this is an assumption on my part, most people don't have 50 or 100 birds that they're dealing with to ship eggs out. So what that means, to me at least, is that we collect eggs and we hold eggs. We collect eggs and we hold eggs, okay? And that's fine. The more often you collect them during the day, the better off those eggs are going to be. Because once you get above 70 degrees, the embryo starts to really rapidly develop. When you hit 80, it really starts to kick into high gear. And when you get up to 90, the embryo starts really growing very rapidly. But you also then have a tremendous loss of moisture from the egg. And that's premature moisture loss due to ill handling of the egg prior to incubation. It's a huge, huge problem. Used to be across the commercial industry, the same thing. They would collect eggs once a day because of labor and cost, and the embryo always suffered. And when these things were looked at long-term as to why a particular breed of birds was only hatching down in the 80th percentile when it should have been up at 90, 92, 93%, okay, they decided that, collecting eggs more often during the day, and then allowing those eggs to be in a room where the temperature is 70 or below before they bring them from the breeder farm to the hatchery. And then in the hatchery, it would be a different story. They'd be down in the right around 50, 55 degrees, 53, 55 degrees in that range. The idea is not to shock them. And, you know, so you you live in California, let's say, and it's 90 degrees wherever you live in California, Southern California. And somebody's out here in Massachusetts on the west, on the East Coast, and it's 2 above zero. And you ship those eggs in, that's a heck of a drop all the way across. And they sit in the post office for another day because the postman went to your house and you weren't home, and so you left a note, and you don't get off till 5, so you get down the next day, and they've been in the hot post office, they've been outside. And you can just paint the picture and look at the scenario and have to understand that you're dealing with a live organism here that is to a great degree fragile, okay? So, well, you know, when you put it all together, you want to make sure that you're handling these eggs in a proper fashion so that you get the maximum hatchability out of them. Whether you are doing this on your farm and the eggs never move off your farm, or you're sending them clear across the country or to Timbuktu, it makes no difference. If you look at incubation is part art and part science. The science part has all been figured out for you. What temperature, what humidity, turn them, don't turn them, when to candle them, when not to candle them, all of that. It's all been figured out for you. The art comes in on your part, okay? The art comes in on your part, and how you handle that egg from the time you pick it up out of that coop and you bring it in the house or wherever you're going to store it until you get enough eggs to ship out to somebody else. And therein lies the problem. I would say to you that eggs from real young breeders have just been put together maybe for the first time, just coming into their own, and never have been really bred before. You usually get your smallest chicks from them as a general rule, and they're not always the most viable in the beginning. And as those birds mature, the eggs get a little bit bigger. The embryos get a little bit better, and if all of these things fall into place, there's so many things that have to fall into place nutritionally, all of the vitamins, the electrolytes, the amino acids. We talked about amino acids. We talked about fat-soluble vitamins. We talked about water-soluble vitamins, how important it is to have all this stuff, and that the B vitamins, you see most of those as abnormalities in birds with the curled toes with the riboflavin deficiency because those are not stored at all. Those are taken in by the breeder, used, and excreted. And if they are not enough of them there, guess what? She's not going to put enough in the egg, and when a chick is born, here we got a problem. Okay? So it's real easy to see it. And you usually don't see the A, D, E, and K, the fat solubles, as a problem. You do on occasion, but you generally don't because those are stored. So
right.
She's getting enough of those, she's going to be keep putting it in and putting it in and putting it in. It's not a problem. But if you don't have enough of the others, you're going to run off the road and you're going to have some problems and you're going to have somebody on the other end telling you you sold them crappy eggs and blah, 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 blah. Not necessarily so, you see, because if you don't know, you don't know, and you just assume that everything should be okay. And we all know what happens when you assume. So it's extremely important, this loss of moisture from this egg also contributes to eggs that don't hatch well when you ship. Guess what? When you lose some of that moisture, you see, that moisture that's in the egg, that albumin and everything else that's in the egg, the moisture part of it, helps keep everything in place. Okay? There's two little shock absorbers in there that hold that yolk in that liquid to keep it stabilized. The chalaza, whatever you want to call it, okay, C-H-A-L-A-Z-A, okay? And when you don't have enough liquid in that, guess what? Slip-slop from one side to the other, slip-slop from one. It's like a soda bottle. Take the soda bottle, drink half of it, and just roll it back in your hand. That's what you're seeing, okay? It's the same basic thing. Now take that same soda bottle or water bottle, and that's full, and you don't get that action. Okay. So if you're shipping a fresh egg that's really, really fresh from really good breeding stock that isn't too old and isn't too young, you're probably going to have a real good hatch rate on the other end, irregardless of how the eggs were bounced around, okay? Because they're going to have that ability to keep that embryo in the air cell where it belongs to everything else. But if you don't, embryo mortality will generally be fairly high. I believe there was somebody on there that had a whole bunch of eggs, a dozen or so eggs, and I don't think any of them hatched, or one or two of them hatched. That's pretty poor. But there's a reason for that. Okay? There's a reason for that. And all of this makes all the difference in the world. But so if you're going to gather your eggs, you want to gather them frequently, okay? You want to have all eggs large end up, okay? Because there are other things after you get the eggs from somebody that were, let's say, handled properly, stored properly, shipped as best they could be shipped, and you got them and they're all in good shape, and you incubate these eggs. It's called malposition, and the normal position for a bird is with its head under its right wing. And as it rotates in the shell, it will tip the shell, and it will use the power of the angle of the right wing along with its head to push the top of the shell off and hatch out and become a viable chick. Any other position is it called a malposition, same thing as breech in humans, and the chances of survival are very slim. Myself, I'm not a big fan of candling. I see people all the time, they're constantly candling their eggs and everything else. I'll say this, we have evidence, and we've talked about it on this show. We've talked about circadian incubation. A lot of people may not have heard of it, but we did a whole show on circadian incubation and all of the different things that go on. And we also know that on the human side, okay, that things that happen in the womb also transfer out to the developing fetus. Same thing happens with chicks. We know we can influence their taste by exposing them to a particular type of a smell during incubation. The studies I saw was done with vanilla, a very heavy smell, and when the birds were hatched out, they were able to take that same vanilla and put it in feed and offer it to the birds, and the majority of the birds went for the vanilla versus the non-vanilla feed. We also know that we can hatch birds through circadian incubation, changing that circadian clock, okay? And we can do that by raising the temperature up for a specific period of time, and it's something that has to be done, temperature up very quickly and then back down very quickly over a period of about 4 hours, about the 16th, 17th day of incubation, and we can make those chicks more tolerant to heat, which is an important thing for countries where it's blazing hot, and which is getting to be the thing around here lately, but and we could do the same thing by lowering that temperature during that same time, changing that circadian clock around a little bit, okay, and making them less susceptible to cold, more tolerant to it. So what you do with these birds, temperature-wise, before you incubate them, during incubation, handling, all of these things has an outcome on the quality of the chick at the end of the day. I'm not going to go into it today because it's not part of this particular thing that we're talking about, the embryology part of it, but it is important to keep in mind that while a chick has hatched out at 21, 22 days, whichever way you want to look at it, okay, that it is not complete at that point. It looks to you as if it's complete because the umbilicus is closed, the navel is healed, and the chick is chirping and eating and pooping and doing all the things that a little chick does. But in the first few hours of its life, it is getting the necessary bacterial microbiota of the gut going. We're going to talk about this in a whole show that I'm putting together for this to explain to everybody what this is all about. But that gut is extremely fragile and extremely immature. It's going to take another 2 to 4 weeks for that gut to mature. So whatever you do to it during that period of time in the very beginning, you will pay down the road if you don't do it right.
Mm-hmm.
And that is extremely important. For getting good quality chicks, birds that grow. I've seen posts with people, you know, what's up with the bird failure to thrive. Some of that is related to how they were raised in the beginning. We talked about prolapse earlier for a few moments. And all of this stuff, it all points to the same thing, to looking at all of this as far as how that embryo is going to turn out at the end of the day. So you can do a lot to save yourself a lot of aggravation. You're going to save time. You're going to save money because you won't have to medicate as often. The bird's going to be healthier. About 60 to 70% of the bird's immune cells lie within the intestinal tract. It behooves you to keep that intestine healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Because a good, healthy gut is going to end up with good, healthy chicks, chicks that thrive, that grow, that put on weight, that give you less trouble and less expense at the end of the day. And you know my feeling, dead birds don't pay bills.
Exactly right.
I don't care who you are. You know, I may sell this stuff, but dead birds don't pay bills. So, Andy, it's top of the hour. You want to take your break?
Yeah, let's go ahead and take a break here, folks. We're talking with Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, founder of First State Vet Supply. Fabulous show today. Very special episode talking all about incubation and really everything that goes along with that, even down to the eggs and the producing of the eggs and the shipping of the eggs. And it's just amazing. So hopefully you are taking a lot of notes and you're enjoying today's show. And we will return right after this short break from our sponsors.
Established in 1957, GQF has become the name to trust when it comes to quality products and superior customer service. GQF offers a wide range of poultry products, including incubators, brooders, feeders, waters, and much, much more. Give them a call at 912-236-0651 or visit them online at GQFradio.com. That's GQFradio.com.
Pictures of chickens on aprons are common across America, but picture a chicken wearing an apron and you'll probably get a good chuckle. Laugh if you must, but nothing protects hens better than the Hen Saver Hen Apron. Hen Saver Hen Aprons protect your hens from the damage caused by an overly affectionate rooster and may even provide protection from an unexpected hawk attack. Hen Savers come in several different sizes to fit both bantam and standard-sized hens and roosters. Colors include camo, denim, navy, brown, khaki or black, and soon pink. Crazy K Farm is expanding its already colorful Hen Saver collection to include the color pink. A portion of their sales will be donated to organizations that fund breast cancer research and awareness. Order your Hen Saver aprons today at hensaver.com. That's hensaver.com.
Mount Healthy Hatcheries has been a hatching tradition for over 80 years. Home of the healthiest chicks, Mount Healthy Hatcheries offers a wide selection of bantams, turkeys, guineas, ducks, pheasants, and of course, meat birds and layers. Order online at mounthealthy.com, that's mthealthy.com, or give them a call at 1-800-451-5603. Don't forget to ask about their free bonus chicks offer. Mount Healthy Hatcheries, home of the healthiest chicks.
It's easy and rewarding to keep backyard chickens, and My Pet Chicken can supply everything you need to get started, including baby chicks, chicken coops, accessories, books, and free how-to information, plus fun gifts and rooster decor. At My Pet Chicken, you can buy as few as 3 baby chicks. They also sell fertile hatching eggs. Visit them online at mypetchicken.com. That's mypetchicken.com.
Introducing the Chicken Fountain, a new way to water your flock. The Chicken Fountain will change your life and keep your chickens healthier by providing clean, fresh water every time. No more daily cleaning of dirty chicken waterers. This semi-sealed system keeps every drop of water fresh and clean. Proudly made in the USA, the Chicken Fountain will provide your flock with fresh, clean water for years to come. To order your Chicken Fountain, visit chickenfountain.com. That's chickenfountain.com.
Hey, it's the Chicken Whisperer, here to tell you that if you have backyard poultry, nothing is more important than making sure your feathered friends are safe from infectious poultry diseases. Learn the simple steps to keep your birds healthy by visiting this website, healthybirds.aphis.usda.gov. That's healthybirds.aphis.usda.gov.
A message from the USDA.
How would you like a punch in the beak?
Actually, in reality, I am Super Chicken.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. Again, being Monday, we've got and are very proud to have Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor, founder of FirstStateVetSupply.com. Our topic today, as if you're just tuning in, is all about incubation. And as Doc hinted a little bit earlier in the show, all of our radio shows are archived. They always have been. This is our fifth year of broadcasting. We have over 800 shows that are archived. You can listen to them free on iTunes.com, podcast.com, zoom.com, and of course, blogtalkradio.com. And most all of the 800 episodes are labeled. You can scroll back and see if there's a particular topic that Peter's done that you want to listen to and get that information and take those notes. It is a great resource, and we're glad that we do have all the shows archived for your listening pleasure. And as I always do very quick, let me go ahead and send a shout out to all the great folks that are listening live today. We thank you very much for tuning in. The folks that are in the chat room today, we thank you, and we're glad that your internet or IT person at work allows you to get into the chat room. It's always great fun there. All the homeschoolers that listen to the show, thank you very much for tuning in. We're glad you incorporate the show into your learning curriculum there at home. All the over-the-road truck drivers we hear from that listen to the archive to, I guess, keep them awake at all hours of the night when they're delivering the load. So keep the rubber on the road. We thank you for doing so. And all the feed and seed stores across this great land that stream the show live to their customers every day, Monday through Friday at 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Thank you as well. And the archive listeners, if I didn't mention that. We'll go over the phone lines now. We'll bring back on Peter Brown, also known as the Chicken Doctor. And Peter, we got plenty of time, so we will continue with all your expertise.
Yeah. So I want to move on. I think I've made the point, you know, about the breeders and all that kind of stuff and, you know, shipping and handling of the eggs. Just want to make one more comment on that about, you know, when you if you're going to store these eggs and you're holding them for shipping purposes, you know, gathering up enough, you've got an order for 24 and, you know, you've got 4, 5, 6 birds or whatever it is. So I know some people have more birds than that. I'm just throwing out numbers, but just to give you an idea. So if you're going to hold them, you want to put them in a place where it is relatively cool, but you don't want that temperature to drop so drastically. So let's, for argument's sake, say it's 90 degrees outside when you go out and you collect the eggs. And maybe in your basement, if you have one, or a particular room in your home where it's going to be about 70, 75 degrees, I would make that transition and just let them sit still. Okay, and the final time that you're going to depending on how much time you've got to collect all these eggs and get them together, if you're going to hold them long term, more than a couple of days, I would suggest that you drop that temperature down to 55 to 60 degrees. Okay, and you want to have about 85% humidity. So the more humid it is, actually, the better, because you want to keep that liquid, so to speak, within the egg. You don't want it to be evaporating out, because that's where the problems really start to come into play. So just from that standpoint, I think that's enough said about that part of it. The handling of it is just as critical as it is shipping, and a better quality egg you can ship out, the better the chances are for the person receiving the eggs to have positive results, and then espouse to everybody how great your eggs were and that they should buy their eggs from you for various reasons, one of them being the success of the incubation process. But just remember, incubation is part science and part art, and the science part has all been figured out. The art's on you, and that's where it comes into play of all these other little things that you do to keep these embryos viable. Again, I'm not a big fan of candling eggs, but there's three days at least that you should stay away from candling the eggs, and that would be the fourth day, the ninth day of incubation, and the 17th day. And the reason for this is that if you look at the embryo, and we did this show over a year ago or so, we did it during hatching season, and the rapid development of the embryo of the chicken, because it all has to be started and developed and finished and out of the shell by 21 days outside of the bird's body, it's an incredible amount of things that have to happen. But certain things happen at certain times, and they are so critical that if you are spinning an egg to look at it and you're doing it during that period of time, you'll probably end up with embryo mortality. On the fifth day, the allantois of the bird is pushing outside of the bird's body and connecting itself basically to what you would know as the cloaca of the bird. When it's doing that, it's connected by a small, what they call a stalk. If you break that, you're done. Over. Finished. So stay away from the fourth day, and I think you're going to be okay there. The ninth day, you're going to have the same thing with the allantois being outside the bird's body and starting to surround the embryo. And if you're in there twirling it around and flipping it all around and stuff, it's going to interfere with that. And the 17th day, you want to stay away from there. I don't see why anybody would want to candle them anyway this late. That's just my opinion. When I ran a hatchery and ran it very successfully for several years, hatched a zillion chickens. Once we got the joint cleaned up after I first got there, we very rarely candled the eggs at all. It just was counterproductive. I couldn't see the point of it, opening up these huge machines and pulling out all these eggs and just to see what was still living. You'll find it out at the end of the day, and if your mortality is that high, you can always go back later on in subsequent hatches and look and see what went on. I would keep good records. That's another thing I would suggest people do. Keep good records as to, you know, where their eggs came from, what breeders you had together at that point in time, and what were the conditions, weather, all those things, what you were feeding, what you didn't feed, supplements, no supplements, all that kind of stuff, disease problems during the time that you were collecting those eggs, if you had any. So all of those things play into it. But the embryo at this point of the game, 17 days, is preparing for hatch. And if you go flipping the egg around again, you could cause that malposition to take place, and it's really critical. You might not think it's a big deal, but it is critical. And if that head is not under that right wing and giving that bird that leverage between the wing and the head to push the top of that shell off once it's spun around in there and used its chick tooth to break through, you're not going to get anywhere. You're going to have embryo mortality, and you're not going to be a happy camper. And more than likely. And again, nothing's absolute, nothing's 100%. People that do it, more power to you if that's what you want to do. I'm just telling you what research has shown over the years, and even my own. When I was in the hatchery, we just got away from doing it. It was just so counterproductive that I didn't see a need for it. Now, if we had some hatches that came out what we call a delayed hatch or whatever, we go back and look at the records, because it kept records on every machine, every day, multiple times a day. You had to go through. There was a chart hung on front of each machine. You had to write down whether the turner was working, the machine was even on. We had to do that. We had some people who couldn't tell the difference. And, whether the humidity was correct, the temperature was correct, and all of that stuff. And once you open up that incubator, everything you've worked, that art on your part and that science, you just let it all out of the box. And now you got to start it all over again. You're exposing that embryo to all kinds of temperature changes and humidity changes and so on and so forth. It's not a good thing. It's not a good thing at all. And but if you're happy doing that, and if you've been doing it for a long time and you're comfortable with it, far be it from me to tell you to do it different. I'm just telling you, you know, how I would approach it. So if we have a vitamin A deficiency, we're probably going to see some early mortality. And this is what I was saying before. We generally don't see a lot of this. At least that's not one of the complaints that I usually hear. Most of the time it's later. But we start seeing the embryo mortality usually in the first 48 hours. And again, these are your fat-soluble vitamins, and they are stored within the bird's the female's body and passed on into the to the yolk, and generally are not always found deficient. I want to say this about the vitamin deficiencies. I know we said it in the last two episodes, but you know, a lot of the things that you see on the internet about vitamin deficiencies and you read, you know, are they true? Sure. But they happen so rarely today compared to, you know, back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s when they didn't really even understand, you know, what were the actual total nutrient requirements of birds. You know, things have evolved over the years. We understand it now. We know what they need. And when you we talked about a complete feed last week or so, what it means about having all of the vitamins and minerals and amino acids, proteins, the carbohydrates, the fats, and everything in that feed that the bird needs to survive on. Amino acids being, you know, the most important. We talked about the ones that were essential and non-essential and what the difference was between the two. And if you want to listen to that, you can go back and listen to last week's show and the week before, and you can have a grand time listening to all of that, and it explained it all. But any one of those that is deficient, you're going to have an embryo that's not going to develop properly. So it's not just the vitamins. It is the amino acids. They are the building blocks of life, human or otherwise. And on that note, an egg contains all of the amino acids. The chicken egg, as glorious and wonderful as it is, contains all of the amino acids that a human will need. Okay? Just keep that in mind. All of the amino acids that a human will need. That's huge. That is huge. Mortality from chicks for vitamin D3 deficiency, okay, another fat-soluble vitamin. These chicks are stunted, small, and you can actually take their legs, and you'll know it when you see it because you can actually take their legs and they're bendable. The lack of the vitamin D3, again, the three-way intersection, the calcium may be there, but if the vitamin D3 is there, guess what? We're not going to have the calcification of the legs the way they need to be. So that's one of the problems you'll see there. We usually see what they call a depressed hatch. This would be a hatch that, it, you know, you were expecting a lot of birds, and all of a sudden, they're on, you know, and so it could be that. And the vitamin E, we usually see this early embryonic mortality, 1 to 3 days, and this can lead to swelling of the brain. This might be some of the vaulting of the skull and things for particular breeds of chickens, or exposure of the skull where the skull didn't close. This twisting of the neck when birds are dried off and out of the incubator have this twist of their neck and stuff. We've seen that where vitamin E has a tendency to correct that. Could very well have been a problem with a breeder that hen or whatever that it was deficient in vitamin E. It certainly could be a genetic abnormality, too. We talked about that a little bit earlier, where a bird, you can supplement it with it and it'll do fine, but you take the supplement away and the bird does poorly, and that's generally a genetic thing where they're not able, for whatever the reason, to absorb it out and use it in the fashion that it needs to be used in. So basically, those are three of the four. Vitamin K deficiency, you would see a lot of blood hemorrhaging under the skin. And that kind of thing. Embryo mortality, they just don't survive that kind of a situation. Riboflavin, one of the B vitamins, usually see this a little bit later, 9 to 14 days. Can happen as late as 17 to 21. I would say basically anywhere from 9 to 21 days of age, so it's a widespread. They get a clubbed down instead of the down being nice and smooth and everything else. It's all clubbed up and lumped up. They have an edema about them, the excessive of water retention under the skin and stuff. They kind of look bloated for what they are. Panathenic acid and other water-soluble vitamins, we can see this. This has to be differentiated between a vitamin K deficiency, but we see hemorrhaging under the skin. You see this a lot sometimes with birds that are hatched, and there's a lot of blood around the bird and stuff. It never survives generally, and sometimes you'll see them with the yolk still outside the body, and that's just one of the causes of that of vitamin deficiency. Generally, the pantothenic acid, biotin. You see reduced hatch. Usually, the birds don't hatch well. You'll see shortening of the skeleton and abnormalities of the skin. Generally, you'll see this. I've only seen it early on. I've never seen it late hatch, but it can happen. But generally, it's in the first 3 or 4 or 5 days of hatching. Vitamin B12, you're going to see possible edema there. You'll see mortality generally out at about 14 days of age. And we'll probably not hit it at this show because a couple other things here I want to get to beforehand, but we can come back next week and talk about doing some egg breakouts and what to look for and that kind of thing. A lot of these B vitamins too, you will see the curly toes too. I don't want to leave that out, and that generally can be. If it's just a curly toe situation, it can just be mitigated by correcting it early. Sometimes if you don't correct it early, it becomes a permanent thing. And I've seen that happen before. But generally, you can clean that one up fairly easily. Sometimes with the, especially if there's a multiple deficiency, then you start to see, because it gets confusing, because you start to see multiple things happening then, you start to see some club down, you start to see this thing, you start to see some curled toes, and then you say, look at bird, and you got, rubbery legs. And I've seen this before. I've seen the rickets that birds can get from the calcium phosphorus ratio being out of whack in the breeder and the vitamin D3 deficiency and that kind of thing. And as they start to grow out, you'll see the same thing. The ribs break, reheal, especially if it happens as they're older birds, much more pronounced. When you start to get down to some of the minerals, I talked about the manganese, the magnesium before. Late mortality that you would see with them. This can happen with what you would call retarded growth, and you'll see that with a lot of the minerals, because of the fact that they're all involved. In the formation of bone structure, and this kind of thing. So you'll see all kinds of skeletal abnormalities, and it's hard to look at it and say it's zinc, manganese, or calcium, phosphorus. Generally, the calcium, phosphorus thing I would look for more so, with the bones being soft and that kind of thing. I've seen them in pigeons where you could almost bend it in half without it even breaking, and we traced that one back one time to a vitamin and a amino acid deficiency, and but those things do happen. I had the original show that we wanted to do here, and we'll continue it when we get into the next next week. I had formulated a bunch of questions and answers for my book that I've answered over the years. And as most of you know that are regular listeners, I don't usually read hardly anything. It's 99% for the most part from the top of my little brain. But sometimes these things get long, and the answers are long. And so I'm going to just go through a quick list of abnormalities during incubation and what their general cause is and what you might do to correct that. And then next week, because of the length of it, we can probably go into reading some of these other questions, and maybe that'll give some people some time to formulate some questions and whatever. I don't know if you want to take any questions today, Andy, at all, but it's up to you.
Right.
I don't know if anybody is asking any questions or has any questions or whatever.
There are. I've noticed, but you've been asking them as they've been asking them.
Okay.
They'll ask about what. One question was, what should the humidity be while storing the eggs when you collect them? If they're on the kitchen counter or on the kitchen table or in a shed or something, that was one that specifically was asked. But most of the time, they'll post a question, and you'll actually cover it or already have covered it. Yep.
Okay. One of the other things that is important to talk about here, and again, doing this from the top of my head for the most part today, kind of get off the course and forget about a couple of things, but one of the things that's extremely important about this is, and this again goes back to either vitamin deficiency, calcium phosphorus ratio, vitamin D3 deficiency, or other minerals, shell quality is huge, because if you've got and this, we generally see this diminish as birds become older, not necessarily first year layers, but if you've got birds that are older breeders, 3, 4, 5 years old, you know, we tend to see this, and therein lies a great opportunity for supplementation to help ward this off, because it's generally at that point, you know, either not enough in the diet for a bird that is that old, or can't break down what's in the diet anymore due to age. Happens in humans, happens in chickens, it happens in all animals. I've said this to you folks before. You know, I have a large following at one time, a smaller following now, and people who've raced pigeons. And a lot of the old-timers, when we talked about using Replimin liquid, which is a chelated mineral compound, in the water, and using that for helping to build red blood cells for these birds that were being asked to fly long distances and stuff, you know, they reply from the old-timers, well, I don't need it because I just take a nail and I put it in the water and it rusts, and therefore they get the iron from the rusty nail. And while he's telling the truth, no question, they will use that in 500 lifetimes because it's not available to them at all. They'll not break it down. They'll excrete it out in the droppings, and that's the end of that. No, there'll be no iron of any consequence put into the bird's diet. So, you know, it's kind of like computers, garbage in, garbage out, and you have to be careful what you do when you're trying to get, you know, good quality chicks out. Again, I can't emphasize this part enough. The healthier they are when they hit the ground, and the better condition you keep them in and keep that gut healthy, certainly you got to keep the respiratory system clean and everything else, but, you know, they're generally not born with the respiratory issue. It comes afterwards. So keeping that gut with 60-70% of the immune cells lying within the intestine, especially the cecal tonsils, which are the blind pouches, you know, is very, very important, because a lot of digestion of the food that a bird eats takes place in those blind pouches. So very, very important to keep that part of it up, keeps the bird's health up, keeps you out of the poorhouse, having to medicate all the time, and you know, things of that nature. So it's very, very important. The eggshell quality, porous eggshells usually don't hatch well, and they don't hatch well for the simple reason that they lose too much moisture, and the embryo starts drying out in the shell, and doesn't have an opportunity to suck in the yolk, or doesn't have an opportunity to then spin in the shell and pip itself out. That's why lots of times you'll see birds, it looks like they're going to hatch out, but they break the shell and they just sit there. And that can be a number of things. You know, it can be too much moisture, too little. It can be malposition, meaning that he's able to pip the shell, but he wasn't able to really make it around in there and help get himself out. partly because the wing can be in the way. There's all kinds of abnormal positions as far as that's concerned. But anything other than the head under the right wing is not normal. And refrain from at least the 4th, 9th, and 17th day of even bothering with the eggs in any way, shape, or form. And so you might wonder why people wait, especially on the commercial side, wait till the 18th day to transfer them from the incubator to the hatcher. That's why. They don't even mess with them on the 17th day, okay? And there's a lot of thought now about having them hatch right in a hatcher incubator type setting. A lot of that stuff coming out of Europe and so on. And like I said before, in previous shows, it's great times to be alive. A lot of information going on, a lot of research going on. People looking for different answers to different things. We now know. Some people may have seen it around, but there's a group of Japanese scientists that did some experiments, and we now know that roosters crow at 4 o'clock in the morning, not because they see light, because it's their circadian clock. It's built in. And we've got to come up with a real good, valid reason as to why they crow at 4 o'clock in the morning, but it has nothing to do with the seeing of light. And that has been proven by taking birds and putting them in a dark out situation where there's absolutely no light, and then shining lights in their face, and they just sit there. But come 4 o'clock, light or no light, they crow. So it's an interesting thing. And again, we talked a while back about the circadian clock and how important it is, and how that's involved in even egg laying and the timing of the eggs and whether they lay eggs early in the day or late in the day and so on. So and even laying eggs late in the day can be detrimental to the hatch, because if you're not out there more than once a day collecting the eggs, that one sits all day long and all night long until you come back out the next day to get them. So there's a lot to be said for going out and getting those eggs several times a day. And I understand in some cases it's not possible, and you just have to live with the consequences. That's all. So let's start here with the problem first, the possible cause, and then what you might want to do about it, okay?
Okay.
So you candle some eggs, and you don't see any blood vessels at all. And so here we would look at the eggs are not fertile, or for one of the reasons that we've been talking about here today, whether it be nutritional or whatever, handling, shell porosity, any of these things, vitamin deficiency, amino acids, whatever.
And at what day we're candling? At what day?
This could be candling here at 5-6 days.
Okay.
And you don't see anything. The first thing you want to do is again, I strongly urge keeping records of what you did or didn't do to the breeder flock. How was their overall health, in your opinion? We talk about it on this show all the time. Get that 5-gallon bucket out, sit in that yard, get your rocking chair, sit on the porch. I don't care where you do it, but observe those birds. The more you know about them, the healthier they're going to be. It's just that simple. And, when Molly comes across the yard and her tail's dragging, not having a bad day, got a problem. And the quicker you jump on that problem, the better the chances that Molly will survive and the better chances that your wallet isn't going to be short a few bucks. A lot of these things, if you catch them early, it's not a big deal. And if they're, if I had a nickel for every time somebody said, well, I just thought it was, or I just thought it was. And that's why we do these shows, to make everybody as informed as we can possibly make everybody who wants to be informed. And so you want to check the breeder flock. You want to check your records. You want to check the egg holding conditions. How were the eggs held? Where were they held? What was the temperature? What was the humidity? Okay, all of those things. Were the kids behind your back taking the eggs and shaking them? It's possible. I've seen those kinds of things before, and certainly you would want to check the incubator as far as how it's operating, temperature, humidity, turning, not turning, and that kind of thing. Lots of times, in a still air incubator, it's very difficult to get a good hatch lots of times. A lot of people, especially the styrofoam ones, have tried and not been very successful. But one of the keys there is that during the incubation process, you don't want those eggs to be really too close together. because it is the temperature differential that is between eggs that causes embryo mortality because they get too hot. It can be 100 degrees in an incubator, but the temperature in between, because as an embryo grows, it gives off heat. And so the temperature in between, that's one of the keys to the Barinci incubators, especially the early ones they had. The newer ones they have, I'm not so hot on, but they used to have some really nice incubators, and they were what I liked about their incubator at that time was it was hexagon-shaped like the smaller ones, but they were bigger, and they would hold a lot of eggs, but the guts would all come out so you could clean it all at one time, just put it all back in. It was such a breeze, and the turner was on the outside, so you didn't have to mess with that part of it. And you just clean it all out, put it all back together, and put it back on the turning rack and let it turn, and it just slowly turned the eggs one side to another with an external turner. Great machine. I don't know what happened to them, but they don't make them anymore as far as I know, at least not in this country. And now they're making something else that's more like the GQF. And I don't have any clue as to why they've done that, but that was a tremendous incubator. And one of the things about, seeing as we are talking about incubation, the hexagonal shape is that it really didn't allow for any dead air space. It made that air go around those eggs, over, under, around, and through. And they have the research to prove, because they were able to put temperature measuring devices in between the eggs and tell what the temperature was. So, I used to sell their incubators many years ago, and I sold a lot of those particular incubators, and those that still have them, still functioning. The one thing that they always said, put it in a Barinci incubator, if it's fertile, they hatch like popcorn. And one of the reasons for that was, it was the uniformity of temperature across the spectrum of those eggs. Those eggs were not too hot, not too cold at any given time, and allows that embryo to completely develop uninhibited by too hot a temperature and things of that nature. Because you get temperatures that are too hot, can cause a whole slew of abnormalities. A lot of these chicks that you see that are hatched out and the yolk is still on the outside of the body, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, the chick was forced out of the shell due to the heat. So they try to break out too early, and people try to help them out, and then you find out that there's this oldest yolk sac sitting outside of the bird's body yet that's not been sucked in, and afterward they generally don't suck it in, they just generally die. But a lot of that's caused by the temperature being too hot. It could also be caused by temperature being, the humidity being too high as well, because there's too much moisture in the egg. Again, go back to that fine art, that fine balance, okay, that we talked about before. You don't want to lose all of your moisture pre-incubation, meaning sitting in the refrigerator or sitting on the counter or in the basement or wherever. You don't want to lose most of your moisture there. You want to lose that controlled moisture in the incubation where it's going to do you the most good. And therein lies, you know, a lot of the problems, just in the egg handling itself. A lot of problems can be solved right there. But if you've got a lot of dead embryos early on, again, your temperature's probably too high or too low. Can be poor supply of air to the incubator. I've seen that happen before, where people didn't realize that the ports on the incubator were closed, so they weren't getting enough air, and so you get the carbon dioxide buildup in the incubator, and poor nutrition. We've already talked about that kind of stuff. These are all possible causes. So the remedy for that, obviously, is to keep a check on an incubator. Put a pad there. If you've got a tabletop incubator, just get yourself a nice little yellow legal pad and put it there. Today's such and such a date, and today I'm going to write down here the temperature at 9 o'clock this morning when I checked it was such, the temperature was such, it all looked well, the turner's working, everything's good. So you have a record to go back to if things don't work out the way you wanted to, so you can start that process of elimination to get to the bottom of the situation and find out just what's causing the grief here and get it corrected so that you can go on and have these good, viable, healthy chicks. Excuse me. If you've got pipped eggs lots of times, I just said it a minute ago, and they're not hatching, again, it's generally too much moisture in the egg, which is too much humidity in the incubator. if they hatch too early, even though they can be healthy, probably have too high a temperature there, and vice versa. If they're late hatching, what we call a straggled hatch, excuse me. We see a lot of that too. They're very green. They're full of a lot of liquid stuck down the albumin of the egg and stuff. So you'll know all of that when you see it, and you'll also know it when you see the high humidity pieces of shell or shell itself sticks right through the bird. It's very very sticky. So and again, if you go back and check all of these things, as far as you know your temperature, humidity, your turning, and so on and so forth. Going back and again looking at the breeding stock, just keep tracing things back, keeping your records, and the more you do that, you know, the better off all of these things are going to be for everybody. So. Andy, I think that's about where I want to leave off.
Okay. Yeah.
The rest of it might get a little bit, because we're going to go into a little bit more detail next time around into the actual breakout, and I want to give some information out on how to take some eggs that you are willing to part with and determine shell density and whether or not they're too thin and whatever as part of the problem. So we can work through that next time around. But if you got any questions from anybody,
there is one here from Christmas Chick. Please ask early incubation humidity and lockdown humidity. Should eggs be kept at 80% humidity for storage, early incubation, and lockdown?
Yeah, when you're storing these eggs, you're going to want to have that humidity up high. As far as the humidity is concerned for incubation itself, it's right in that same general area. Escapes me right off the top of my head right at the moment. But the main thing that I would be concerned about here is getting the temperature right and getting that egg handling correct in the very beginning, so that if you have all of this stuff correct in the first place, you're not going to have the problems that we've talked about here. With the overall chicks. And when we mean lockdown, I'm assuming they're talking about putting them in the incubator. Is that, I'm not overly familiar with that particular term.
That's what I was assuming, and she's listening, but there's about a 20-second delay, so we'll give her 20 seconds, and then
she'll
come in and specify that. So with Christmas Chick, and she's talking about lockdown, meaning when you set those eggs, and then, hey, you're good to go.
Right.
And give her a second. I think all the others were answered. Oh, she's saying the last 3 days being defining as lockdown.
Oh, whatever the humidity. Usually from the 18th day on, it's not to worry about because it'll take care of itself. Whatever the incubation percentage was of humidity that you had, it'll increase on its own as they start to come out of the shell. So it should be kept at the constant. I just can't remember right off the top of my head. So it'll come to me after we're off the air, I'm sure.
Probably
does.
Yeah, as soon as I say, all righty, thanks for being with us, and hit click, then you'll be like, oh, that's what it is.
No, it's one of those things that you really just don't need to mess with them after that point in time. And like I said, for myself, strictly speaking for myself, I'm not a big fan of candling them at all. I think a lot of people like to do it just to, just for the sake of it, I think. I don't think it's absolutely necessary. You're going to get what you get at the end of the day, no matter how it candles out anyway. You can't change anything.
And then one last question here. Let's see, Ann was asking, what day should I not candle duck eggs, or should I candle duck eggs at all? I think I saw earlier in a post in the chat room. Do you have any information for her?
I don't have I'm not quite the expert on ducks, but I could probably look it up. I probably got a book in here that'll tell me.
Okay, and then she could contact you.
Have her send me an email, and I'll get it figured out for her one way or another.
We'll do that. All righty. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. Again, folks, we'll continue this next Monday. Ask the Chicken Doctor with Peter Brown, the Chicken Doctor and founder of FirstStateVetSupply.com. Awesome, awesome. And as always, you can go back and listen to, if you want to rehear this, listen to it again, get some information, jot it down. If you weren't taking notes during the show today, the show will be archived probably within about 15 or 20 minutes after we leave the air. It will be archived on blogtalkradio.com, and then, of course, probably in the next 24 hours on iTunes.com as well. And, of course, iTunes and Blog Talk, both for the listen to the archive, is absolutely free. So we thank you for joining us. And, Peter, always a pleasure to have you on. Super, super information and very technical and things that we probably have never heard before, even though we may have done this many a times over the years, just things to make you go, things to think about, things to try, maybe things to correct. So thank you for coming on and sharing all of your expertise information with us, and it gives us something to think about and try. So, like I said, getting more successful hatches in the future, hopefully, thanks to the show and your help. So thanks for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you next Monday.
All right, we'll be here.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. Yep. Gotta love Mondays, folks. Peter Brown, the Chicken Doctor, FirstStateVetSupply.com is his website. FirstStateVetSupply.com, as we say, in our opinion, if they don't have it, you don't need it. And they've got some great, great things. And I'll tell you this again. Doc has said on the show, when people call him and have questions, when they call him and have emergencies, he starts off by, you know, getting all the information that he can get, and then he says, okay, let's go ahead and try to start treating this bird. What do you have? And 9 times out of 10, I believe he says the answer is nothing. Okay, so there's some things you want to keep on your homestead, in your backyard, at home, if you keep backyard chickens, backyard poultry, show poultry, you know, heritage poultry, you live on the homestead. So like you said, when you're sitting there looking at those birds, you see something wrong immediately, you can immediately deal with that. For example, that first aid kit you want to have on hand if there's an injury or a predator attack. And, of course, if it's the medical side, Doc has an awesome emergency medicine kit, with medicine and things like that in it. So you can initially start treating your birds immediately and then possibly order more, because you don't want to keep, 36 ounces of something that has an expiration date that may go bad if you use it or not. So he's got in the emergency medicine kit, he's got just what you need to start treatment on your birds until you can actually order more. And so you're saving money all the way around. Plus, you're saving your flock. Emergency medicine kit, I think it's $24.95. What a great deal at FirstStateVetSupply.com, put together by Peter Brown. Directions about everything that's in there, symptoms about things that your birds may have, where you might use the things that are in the kit. So awesome, awesome value, and you can get that anytime, FirstStateVetSupply.com. And we'll return, of course, next Monday with Peter Brown, the chicken doctor. So let me look and see what we've got the remainder of this week. It looks like this coming Wednesday, the 17th, we're going to have Garden Wise Living with Arlena Schott, Garden Wise Living Television. She is here on the first and third Wednesdays. That'll be this Wednesday, and she'll be talking about year-round gardening. No matter where you live, it'll be a great garden show. This coming Thursday, the 18th, we will welcome poultry scientist and professor Dr. Bridget McRae, Ph.D. She will be joining us this Thursday, the 18th. And let's see, and then Friday, I'm going to tell you, this is my busy season, So the Friday show is questionable. I've got an event on Saturday the 20th in Mobile, Alabama. I'm probably leaving Thursday, possibly right after the show. And so I'm not sure if we'll be on the road on Friday, where there will be a show this Friday or not. But nonetheless, you can tune in tomorrow. We'll have a special guest for you, possibly Prepper Penny for tomorrow. Wednesday, Gardenwise Living with Arlena. Thursday, poultry scientist and professor Dr. Bridget McRae, PhD. And maybe no show Friday as we get down to the Mobile Bay Area for our big event this weekend. So stay tuned when you can and follow us on Facebook. Make sure you're collecting those daily passwords. There'll be 30 in the month of April, so you'll have a chance to win that awesome chicken coop from MyPetChicken.com. All righty, my name is Andy Schneider, known as the Chicken Whisperer. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you can join us every day, Monday through Friday, 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here on Blog Talk Radio. God bless everybody.
Oh.